Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. We're absolutely delighted that Dr. Nina Moore is here with us today. She received her BA from Knox College and her MA and PhD in political science from the University of Chicago. She is an associate professor of political science at Colgate and previously held teaching positions at DePaul University, the University of Minnesota, and Loyal University of Chicago. The Princeton Review named her one of the best 300 professors in the United States in 2012. Among Dr. Moore's various community posts is her service on the editorial board of the Ralph Bunche Journal of Public Affairs. Governor David Paterson appointed Dr. Moore to the New York State Commission on Judicial Conduct, which is responsible for deciding complaints against state judges. And the New York State Senate appointed her to an advisory commission on underage alcohol consumption and substance abuse. Dr. Moore's research focuses on the dynamic relationship between race and institutional process, and she has written various articles and papers on Congress, the Supreme Court, and public policy. She is the author of two books so far, and is currently completing a book manuscript that argues the need to look beyond conservative ideology in order to fully understand modern U.S. Supreme Court rulings on race and affirmative action. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Nina Moore.
Thank you. Thanks for that, Eileen. Thanks also for the invitation, and thanks to the audience for giving me a chance to talk about something I've been talking about for a very long time, and for some reason it doesn't seem to get old to me, and unfortunately it's not an old issue yet. So if it's okay with you guys, I'd like to sort of skip the foreplay and just jump right in, because I have about 30 minutes of time, and I have a tendency to go over time, so that's why I want to just jump right in and leave at least enough time for us to have a dialogue, because I've already started a bit of dialogue with a few of you, and I'd like to continue that with the audience as a whole. So I've got some slides I'm going to flip through here. So most of us have heard about the police shootings in the news, and I guess I could say that these shootings have started something of a national conversation about race in law enforcement, and I think it's right to think about these shootings, to be concerned about these shootings, to highlight them as well, and sort of unpack what the shootings are about. But I argue that these shootings are really just symptomatic of a much deeper problem. But I'll go ahead and just explain that deeper problem consists of mass incarceration first, and also over-criminalization, both of which I'd be happy to share with you the details of as we get through this. And it's not just that these problems are here, but that they've existed for decades, not just year after year, but decade after decade. And we could go all the way back to the early 1900s and see that this problem is still with us. So what I ask is in essence, why is this the case? Why has there been no public policy reform of this issue? Why is it continuing to go on, even though we know that it's problematic? So that's the question I ask. Let me start by laying out what I don't address, and I probably couldn't offer you any definitive insights on. And that's the question of what causes crime. That's a very complex issue. I will have something to say about it. I summarize some of the very vast literature on it. I also don't resolve or really address the issue of whether there is racial bias in law enforcement. So the fact that I'm talking about this is not necessarily implying that there is a problem with racial bias, nor for that matter is it dismissing it. And then finally, I'm not addressing the issue of race in law enforcement in our area, so I'm afraid I won't be able to offer too much insight there. So if you're still interested anyway in what I have to say, I'll continue. And I don't take on these issues, as I sort of indicated earlier, is because they're very well studied. I mean, there's just a vast, vast literature. And so what I wanted to do is tackle a question that's understudied. And that's the question of what is it that accounts for the limited concern. So in my book, I give the answer, we are the people, in essence. We enable the problem of overcriminalization and also mass incarceration. And so I'll just tell you what I do in the book is I have about 8 chapters, 68 tables and figures, about 950 footnotes, and I'm not going to be able to go through all of those. I know, I wish I could, but I think what I'll do is just sort of package it neatly in a story, something of a whodunit story, the main characters of which include the media, public opinion, political parties, lawmakers, and what I call the law and order approach to crime fighting. So let's start with the media. There's a sense out there that mass media reinforce the stereotype of blacks as criminals. And this is said to be true, especially of television news. And research shows that there is something to this thinking. Television news does propagate something that I refer to as the blacks our criminal script, and the script goes a little bit like this. I don't know how many of you actually follow social media, but it's hide your kids, hide your wives, grab your purse, lock your doors. There are black people nearby, and so you should be fearful. More specifically, what very careful research shows is that, first of all, there is an exaggeration of the extent to which we have a problem with violent crime in the news. And when that violent crime is covered, more often than not, it has a black face, what I call a scary black face, that is associated with it. And at least one of the figures or one of the pictures shown here, I think some of you will be familiar with. So we look at this. Every night you watch the news, I promise you, when you watch the news tonight, you will see this, and you will see it tomorrow, and the next day, and the next day. So we could step back and we could say, aha, the news media is to blame for this. But the fact is, the news media only sell what the public is willing to buy. It's a commercial industry. So what that means is we have to look at what the public is willing to buy. And as it turns out, the public tends to buy stories that fit within sort of the belief framework to which it already ascribes. In other words, the public likes to watch what it's already comfortable with, what it already believes, and to reject things that sort of are at odds with that ideological framework. And so when we look at what the belief framework of the public is in regard to blacks, here are some of the things that sort of stand out. And one is this belief that whatever happens to someone is the result of that individual's own choices. In essence, we ascribe to individualism. Individualist ideology actually runs very deep in the American political thought tradition. So by extension, that means that as far as the public is concerned, if there is a race problem, if blacks are overrepresented, it must be because there are things that blacks are doing to account for this. And so if we look more specifically at some other tenets, you might be surprised to hear me say these beliefs aren't there because the public is in denial about whether there is a race problem in the system. The public isn't. And survey data show that a majority of Americans, black and white alike, actually believe that racial profiling is widespread. A significant proportion also believe that race plays at least some role in the overrepresentation of blacks in prison. So, there is this recognition of at least some form, some degree of racial impropriety in law enforcement. But that doesn't serve to sort of overshadow the system as a whole. And the reason it doesn't is because of other beliefs about blacks themselves. The idea that there is something wrong with black people. 41% of white Americans believe that blacks are more prone to violence. Now, you might think, well, it's not a majority, but heck, that's a significant number. But hold on to your seats, because here's another statistic. I just quoted you about 41% of whites. 40% of blacks believe the same. And so one of the things I quote in the book is a remark from Jesse Jackson, in which, you know, I'm paraphrasing, in which he says something like, nothing pains him more than to be walking down the street at night, hearing steps behind him, turns around to see that it's a white person, and he's relieved. So it's not blacks who are not in the know. It's not blacks who are not, you know, quote unquote, truly black, and whatever that means. So there is this belief of blacks, and it's a pervasive belief, at least pervasive enough that we're talking a significant proportion of the American public. Conversely, there is a belief that police officers are heroes. In fact, viewed even more favorably than Supreme Court justices, more favorably than priests, more favorably than attorneys. Okay, I know the last one isn't a surprise, but still. So when you take this portrait of blacks on the one hand and the portrait of police officers on the other hand, and what it is that police officers are engaged in, you can sort of understand why the public is sort of willing to look askance, to sort of, you know, look aside from the racial improprieties that the public knows to exist. So if police officers are partly to blame, blacks are primarily to blame. So it follows that when you ask Americans, what should policymakers be focusing on as they approach the criminal justice system? Most say make the system tougher. And this is the case even when you place, and I did this in a few national surveys that I ran for the study, when you place these two options side by side and you say, well, what if you could do both and you could elevate them? They gave them six choices. It was still. So it's not focus on making the system tougher, more so, but instead of, and again, I hope in the dialogue we can get into more statistical details. So for their part, politicians, as usual, have been more than happy to give the public what it wants. And we're seeing that in the ongoing presidential debate. Give the people blood. If that's what they want, give them blood. And that's pretty much what happens here. From the late 1960s onward, starting particularly in 1968, policymakers put in place a set of gruelingly punitive law and order policies. And those policies happen to very closely correspond over time with the ebb and flow of criminalization and also imprisonment. So, of course, you need an excuse. You need to have an explanation. So as they went about putting these policies in place, they constructed a narrative that would justify what was being done. And I refer to that narrative as the party playbook. And the party playbook consisted of these kinds of themes. First, violent crime is spreading like wildfire all over the country. And I have tons of quotes from the party platforms, and this is sort of toning it down, believe it or not. A second theme is if you stand up for criminals, then that means you are not with victims. It's either or. You have to choose. Thirdly, the special, quote-unquote, special victims of crime are women, children, and the elderly, not blacks. And then finally, there is a drug epidemic. This is my favorite. I just couldn't figure out which quote to choose to sort of illustrate this theme. But it went something like this. Drugs are the most dangerous evil to American society, more troubling than terrorism. You know, the whole country is going to go to hell in a handbasket if we don't get a handle on drugs. It is an epidemic, the problem of drugs. So with that reasoning, the high levels of Black imprisonment that was being observed were regrettable, but nonetheless acceptable, because after all, it was necessary to save the country from illegal drugs. Now, the fact is, it wasn't just Republicans. We like to blame Republicans. It was Democrats and Republicans. And that's why I have both of their logos there. Following Willie Horton, Joe Biden got on board, and instead of sort of saying, you know, Willie Horton is not the representation of Blacks, and this probably wasn't the best way to approach an ill-conceived crime-fighting approach, but instead he got on that bandwagon. He said, I want to lock up Willie Horton too. And we know what Clinton did. He signed the three strikes, you're out, and continued to sort of propagate this narrative of crime being an epidemic problem that was spreading nationally. Well, this rhetoric that politicians laid out was stunningly disconnected from reality. Stunningly disconnected from reality. And here's how it's the case. Violent crime was not spreading throughout the country. Certainly it was increasing, it was becoming more problematic. But it was increasing chiefly in the inner city, where Blacks lived in significant numbers, where Blacks were concentrated. Secondly, the special victims of crime, if anyone was to receive special attention, special protection, it should have been Blacks. And to just give you a couple of statistics, then and now, Black children are 6 times more likely to be the victim of a homicide than their white counterpart. Black women, 3 times more likely to be the victim of a rape. So, in essence, Blacks continued to be the special victims, but the narrative didn't capture that. And then finally, that drug epidemic that we kept hearing about. The data from the University of Michigan showed fairly consistently that the percentage of the group involved in the study representing a national sample barely reached 6% in terms of usage. Right, so, and it hovered closer to 5% all of these years. Yet, the way the drug war was executed, it was mostly Blacks who were ensnared in the form of arrests and also imprisonment. So, in sum and substance, the who's, where's, how's, and what's of crime remained substantially racial in nature. It continued to have a Black face. Yet, when putting in place the law and order agenda, that was approached in a very race-neutral fashion, a colorblind fashion, as if Blacks didn't continue to have a special stake in the crime policy process. And so I cannot believe I'm actually getting ready to wrap up shortly here in 16 minutes. This is a record for me. That means more talking with you. I'm excited about that. But here's what the law and order policy agenda consists of today. And these laws were sort of etched in stone between 1968 and 1994. First and foremost, the federalization of criminal law. Most of you know that fighting crime is primarily and was envisioned by the framers to be something that state and local governments would superintend. But you had all this money in the 1960s, and you had these interest groups who were, becoming more actively involved in contributing monies. And so lawmakers wanted to get into the crime fighting business. They wanted to be able to send home the pork and have a reason to do so. And so crime fit the bill. Crime literally paid for these lawmakers. And they did so by creating, on top of the layers of state and local crime laws, a whole slew of federal laws. And it's to the extent that the Heritage Foundation, the conservative think tank that some of you may be familiar with, found that there are so many federal crime laws on the books that there are too many for the Congressional Research Service to count. And to this day, nobody really knows how many there are. Yeah, there are literally thousands. A second element of the law and order policy agenda is incarceration-centered approaches to fighting crime. We send people to prison for the most minor infraction of crime. We send people to prison for not paying a parking ticket. We send people to prison for not showing up for a court date. We send people to prison for minor non-violent offenses. And that seems right to us as a society. It seems right that if someone breaks a criminal law, they should go to jail. Thirdly, a host of post-prison punishments became the new go-to for crime fighters. And what this means is, well, after a person has served his or her time in prison, they are strapped with additional punishments that, in many instances, go with them for the rest of their lives. And they're sort of bizarre when you think about it, because if the purpose of prison is to rehabilitate and to provide for reentry into American society, here are the sorts of things you're not going to do. Okay. You're not going to shut them off from getting an education. Yet, if one has a drug offense, you are not, for a period of time, eligible for subsidized federal loans. In addition to that, in all but about 15 states in the District of Columbia, one does not regain the right to vote. In some, there's permanent disenfranchisement. And so when you think about that, what that really means is being disconnected from society, not having a say, and therefore not having an interest in mainstream society. Another kind of post-conviction, post-prison punishment is not having access to public housing. So this means people are more likely to be living outdoors on the streets, and I'm not sure how that's going to make all of us safe. Perhaps the worst is not only the denial of federal welfare benefits, that is, federally funded welfare benefits, but also enabling employers, and this is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission that has sort of stamped a theory of negligent hiring, which means that if you hire a convict and there are consequences, then the employer can be held liable. And the result of that is that folks don't want to hire people coming out of prison. So we've got 2 million people currently now in prison. We put more people in prison than any other country. And so when they come out, where are they going to go? And if they have no options for educational advancement, no options for economic sustenance, no interest in being part in the political process, then how are they to be reconnected to society? So, and I conclude with this, we are the man. We have this tendency to keep focusing on police officers, to keep focusing on what's happening in the streets. But the authority and the direction that police officers have and that they are acting upon is the authority that we have given to them. When you create a situation of over-criminalization, the inevitable result is over-policing, which sets up in the black community, because you're focusing on violent crime and because of the way the resources are allocated, it creates multiple, innumerable opportunities for clashes between police and the black community. And so the adage of, you know, officer friendly and protect and serve, by way of these policies, by way of these politics, by way of our ways of thinking, ultimately disappear. And so officer friendly for many blacks doesn't live in the black community because we don't send him there. We send him to do other things. So I conclude with that.
Thank you very much. We'll start with some questions.
I'm already scared because I see a couple of law enforcement officers in the audience, and I see people taking notes, and I was thinking to myself, gosh, I should have talked longer.
Not to worry, I'm a social worker.
Okay. Very good.
You talked about the drug epidemic,
mm-hmm.
and now there's widespread belief that we have an opiate and heroin epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been redefined as a public health problem, not as a criminal justice problem. We're going to have a forum on this epidemic in Fayetteville Manlius. My question is, why wasn't there a forum as a public health problem in the predominantly African-American community?
Well, because it was the African-American community, right? And it was easy. And also because, as I said, there were plenty of resources that needed to be spent. And we know that when politicians spend money, they increase the likelihood of being reelected. What's happening now is those funds are drying up. There was a surplus during the Clinton years to the extent that that administration literally put together a crime trust fund and incentivized states using a penal approach, building prisons, building boot camps, and so forth. But we're in different economic times, and that sort of approach isn't as affordable. Additionally, we pay roughly, what, $29,000 per year per prisoner. We can't afford that. And as much as I'd like to think that there has been a change of hearts, which might very well be the case for the public at large and some politicians, I think part of it is that we can't afford to send heroin addicts to prison to the tune of $29,000, when it's, and you know as a social worker, it's a heck of a lot cheaper to rehabilitate.
One of my favorite little issues is when a college student gets in trouble with the law. He's a college student. A male the same age who is not a college student is called an adult. That aside, in the school system, I'm picking up an understanding that one striking you out isn't working very well with young people. How do we get that changed to the criminal justice system?
Where schools are concerned?
Well, no, not necessarily schools, but somehow some of these law and order people realize when it happens to their child that maybe the rules don't apply. Mm-hmm. So I've noticed some real shift in discipline, tolerance levels, that type of thing in the schools. I just wondered if that might be creeping upwards. Mm-hmm. Can things creep upwards or they only go down?
Mm-hmm. There's always, and I think, and I hope I answer your question, there has always been the intersection of class and law enforcement, right? So sort of belying the racial divide as a class divide, and it continues to be racialized because blacks are disproportionately represented amongst the poor. So poor whites have also gotten the short end of the stick in this regard. The sort of get tough on crime approach carries through into schools, college campuses, and many other places. Until we understand that that is not what is driving down crime, that is not what increases crime, then it continues. And so that's why I began with what is our understanding of what the issue is here and what the problem is here. And I hope this connects even more directly to what you're saying. Many of us are under the impression that Rudy Giuliani's broken window strategy is what decreased crime in New York, right? Most of us have heard that. I'm not going to even try to, actually, I might try to flip through to something here. But the thing is, if you look at what happened with crime nationally, the top left, Rudy Giuliani was in office from 1994 to 2000. Crime went down everywhere in the country. So to attribute this to the broken window strategy or something that was being done in New York City, I think is to miss the point. And what it correlates with most closely is the increase in economic prosperity. So to rethink this.
I'm familiar with the Center for Community Alternatives locally, and I'm wondering if you have any information about that. My understanding is that people who go through that system are much less likely to create a crime. I mean, the recidivism rate is much lower, and whether that model is spreading, either in our community or more nationally?
I'm not familiar with specific programs and what their impact has been. I'd be happy to, you know, look at some of that research. I am familiar with the futility of prison, and in fact, there's research to show that reliance on prison actually increases recidivism. It increases crime, so that 40% of those who are sent to prison return within the space of 3 years. So I can tell you that doesn't work. And part of the incarceration trend is because of that, sort of ignoring that it's not working. But additionally, we talk one game and then we play another. So we say that we are pouring money into prisons to do the sorts of things that you just mentioned. But when you look at the allocation of expenditures across the laws that I talked about, roughly 80% goes to enforcement and a paltry 15 to 20% goes to rehabilitation. So I'm afraid that's the most I can offer in terms of thinking about what programs, specific kinds of programs work. Prison is not it.
You talk about a picture is worth a thousand words. What would you suggest that the media do in making changes in how to present images to the public that keeps reinforcing fear, negative? How would you say not to report a crime? Or what would you suggest is what I'm asking.
I would say to report crime in proportion to its occurrence, right? Report it as much to the extent that it is a problem. What that would mean is we wouldn't see a whole lot of crime stories. Because crime has now returned to its lowest levels since 1973. But if you watch the news, you would get the impression that we need the armed guard at our door. So that would be the first thing. Stop exaggerating violent crime. And then secondly, when there is a violent crime story that's presented and it's associated with a face, to humanize the face. There's research that shows that very seldom is the name of a black suspect given. Very seldom is the defense attorney representing that defendant given. And most often what you hear in the background with that blurb up there is police say he did it. Police say he killed her. And then after a couple of sentences, that gets dropped. So more allegiance to the old innocent until proven guilty. But here's what the reality is. That's kind of a pipe dream, what I just offered you. That's never going to happen. And the reason it's not going to happen is because there's too much money. If it bleeds, it leads. And as long as the public wants that, then that's what the news media will give. And I don't want to get into a conversation about the presidential election, because I really do want to talk about this, but that's part of what we're seeing. A lot of people started out saying, oh, you know, Trump is terrible, Trump is awful, Trump is this, that, and the other. But Trump has several million people behind him who want to hear what Trump has to say, who connect to it. And he referred to it as a show in one of his interviews. He said, you know, people come to these shows because that's what people want to see. So that's, again, why I started out with public opinion. So if I dig it a little deeper and answer the question, well, how do we change the public's mind? Tell the truth. Right now, I'm happy to say that there are a number of senators who are actively involved in reforming sentencing in a number of ways, such as getting rid of mandatory sentencing where it's not appropriate, encouraging law enforcement to draw distinctions between low-level drug dealers, street-level dealers versus drug kingpins, and also helping to encourage employers to not ask that ex-convicts check the box. And it's actually Rand Paul, I'm happy to say, who was leading this effort. And it's a bipartisan effort that's underway right now. So all of that's happening. But did you guys notice that after many of these police shootings, and there was a lot of controversy, a lot of uproar about it, jurors still exonerated many of the officers? Now, some of these were questionable. Some of these shootings were arguably justifiable. Some of them weren't. But they were still exonerated or were not charged at all. So you can change the laws, but ultimately it's the juries that have to understand the context and understand that they're not sort of keeping the country safe from the scary black people. Employers have to be told the truth so that they understand that it was exaggerated, the whole thing. And in other words, there has to be some truth and reconciliation that's going to filter beyond passing laws. And that's when you then get the public more open to think. And the thing is, the research shows that these are not terribly complex problems when the studies of political communication show that when you present information to the public as derived from experts, the public adjusts its thinking. So in other words, the public is bright enough to keep up. We just got to get that information out there.
I was very surprised that I did not hear you mention the word poor in your entire talk.
Actually, I did.
Did
but
you?
That's okay. I did.
You did mention it?
Yeah.
I have a hearing problem.
It's okay. It's okay. I've got a time problem. You've got a hearing problem. We're good.
The thing that seems to me to be the big difference here is education and jobs. And if and I think that it's tied to poor rather than color.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if people could have jobs, could have the education to begin with, mm-hmm. and then the jobs, I think part of the problem would be solved. There is one big thing that happened in the 60s that Rockefeller was forced, properly so, to decrease the number of people in mental institutions. But what happened was those people went out on the streets and there was no community effort to take care of those people. And because of that particular problem, they were targets because of their lack of ability to live in community.
Mm-hmm.
There was a problem that crime increased, and that mm-hmm. certainly was one of the things.
Yeah, certainly. I would agree with you.
By the way, I am the proud grandfather of an Irish African American family.
Okay.
So.
Alrighty then.
And I've been brought up to work. I've worked in this about 60 years in the interracial field.
Mm-hmm.
And poor to me and education is really the key.
Could not agree with you more. If I could follow up, because that's a very common understanding and it's very grounded and it's very right. I will respond by saying this in addition. And if I could paraphrase your argument, and the argument that we often hear is that this is happening because blacks are disproportionately poor, right? It's happening to poor people, undereducated people. And it's because of that, and blacks happen to be disproportionately poor and represented in those who are disadvantaged because of that. To my mind, that sort of begs the question of why are blacks disproportionately among the poor in the first place? And so that brings us back to race. Now, that doesn't mean that there are people intentionally discriminating against blacks, but rather there are historical effects that have been perpetuated over the years that have yet to be corrected. So to begin in the 1960s and onward and say, okay, race no longer matters, perhaps on the books it doesn't, but its historic effects continue to operate through class. So it is both a class problem, but also a race problem.
I've been a little bit of a devil's advocate here, but how do you answer critics who say, and kind of become disassociated with a lot of the things we've been talking about, by just saying, well, it's a breakdown in family structure. I mean, you know, this is just happening, and, you know, if they had a decent family, this whole thing wouldn't be there. How do you answer that?
Well, I answered it at the beginning by saying I can't answer it. I knew I was going to get the question anyway. And so what I do in Chapter 8 of the book is I lay out all of the research and categorize it into four different ways that helps to get at some of the things that you're talking about, and it's this. And I think this ties into the discussion about class. So people are poor partly because of family structure. Doesn't take a rocket science to realize that two incomes equal more than one. Okay, in the absence of a father, is often what we're talking about. In addition to all of the other things, such as role modeling. So socioeconomic disadvantage is in fact there. So then we have to ask the question, well, does this have anything to do with race? And William Julius Wilson, a Harvard sociologist who has studied this, Doug Massey and many others, have argued that family structure doesn't just pop up out of nowhere. That the absence of the black male in the black home, more often than the absence of the white male in the white home, is traceable to that socioeconomic disadvantage in something that he terms the male marriageability index. The fact that black males are hampered by the imprisonment trends, hampered by unemployment, hampered by low skill, hampered by all of these other things which make marriageability less of a prospect, which impacts family structure and so forth. And then throw in there, you're not alone in being a devil's advocate, Charles Murray, Losing Ground, way back in the day, who said, well, there's also the welfare system of the 1960s that helped to contribute to this, that incentivized the breakup of two-parent homes. So I guess in sum and substance, yes, that stuff is there. It is absolutely there. What we call behavioral pathologies. But those behavioral pathologies ultimately have been shown to be traceable to structural forces. I don't want to say they all are, because some people are just stupid. I don't have any research on that. And then some people are just evil, and we don't need research for that. So when I say they're partly resolvable by public policy reform, we're always going to have stupid people. We're always going to have evil people. But the part that we can fix should get fixed.
I'm kind of curious. What has been the result, I think, of the for-profit prison industry?
Oy. Oh, man, where do I go with this? You know, we talk about the for-profit prison industry as if it's the privatization of prisons that is becoming increasingly popular. And there is a prison complex, and there is a whole lot of money to be made. But here's what happened. With the truth in sentencing grants that the Clinton administration began to offer, as I said earlier, incentivizing prisons, said in essence to states, we will give you more money if you ensure that prisoners serve 85% of their sentence. So states thought, okay, we get more money if we put more people in prison. That means we can hire more people. And then on top of it, Clinton said, okay, I want to put 100,000 extra police officers out there, and the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to subsidize their salaries with $50,000 a year. And then we're going to pay for health benefits, we're going to pay for daycare, we're going to pay for education. So yeah, there is the private prison complex, but we employ 2 million people in the criminal justice system. And to change this means some of those folks are going to lose their jobs. And I don't think they're going to be very happy about that. And so there will be resistance, and we're already seeing some of that resistance. And privatization is not nearly as vast and widespread as is the dependence that has developed over time on the part of state law enforcement and local law enforcement on these monies.
Professor, I'm glad I came this morning. This has been fantastic. I brought my 12-year-old son.
I saw that. I was like,
he has school off. He's not suspended, guys. Don't.
Wondering if you were teaching him a lesson.
Don't hold the son credible for the father's sin. But no. When I was his age, conversations would take place whether we'd have a woman president or a black president first, and there would be discussions whether it would even happen in my lifetime. Thankfully, we're going to see both. But as it relates to the Obama administration, what's your review?
Oy.
Of the first black president and under this topic specifically.
Okay, can
softball
I be...
question, softball.
May I be frank just between us and the light post? Nobody else? You won't share? Okay.
Remember, you're on the radio.
I know. A lot of talk. A lot of giving credence to the idea that this problem is real. And so following the tragedy with Trayvon Martin, Obama came out and he said that he himself has been a victim of racial profiling. That was huge because many people had been denying it, saying, you know, this is non-existent. The people who are being pursued, really, they're all criminals. Certainly some of them, maybe even most are, but not all. And so by doing that, I thought he elevated it and validated it at a level that was helpful. But then when asked what's going to be done, he said, I'm kicking around a few ideas with Eric Holder. He's down there in Florida. Something's going to happen. Now, to his credit, he did sign the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010, which allows the Sentencing Commission to commute some of those. Well, it changed the crack to cocaine 100-to-1 penalty structure. Can I just assume most of you all know what that's about? So that was changed. However, that wasn't changed because of leadership on the part of the White House, but because the Sentencing Commission had been pushing for it for years. And even when it was changed, it did not make the new paradigm retroactive. That is underway now. And we don't see it as prominent on the Obama administration's agenda, but I don't know that I necessarily blame him for that because the public's got to be brought along. Now, I say that, but what I'm going to say now may contradict it. Most of those who've been out front on this issue happen to be Republicans. I mentioned Rand Paul, but also Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions was the first in 2007 to begin introducing reforms to get rid of that crack cocaine differential. We all blame Ronald Reagan for the war on drugs. Not so. Not so. That 100-to-1 penalty structure that I just talked about, that was the making of Congress. And that really was the centerpiece of the Drug Abuse Act of 1986, which many see as sort of the legislative centerpiece of the war on drugs. What Reagan sent and had introduced on his behalf by Senator Dole was an act that would have only put in place a 20-to-1 ratio. And Obama in 2010 put in place the 18-to-1 ratio. So Obama's not too far from Reagan in that regard. So while I can appreciate your supportive, you know, diversity in the White House, that's not what it is all about. Again, the Heritage Foundation, a very conservative think tank. I get my regular newsletters. I have to have my coffee first. They've been pushing this. I do not see civil rights organizations, traditional civil rights organizations, pushing it in the same way.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I apologize if I sound a little incoherent because I just flew in from Seattle yesterday, so I'm on a different time zone, but I just wanted to make one comment and then two questions. Okay, the first comment is I thought Arlene had a fantastic comment about the media in this regard, and if you want to speak more to that, that would be wonderful, because one thing I noticed in Seattle is that they have you're forced to watch the news when you're in a hotel, and they brought up positive news in every news segment. I was amazed. And that was really interesting, and it might be something that'd be great to adopt here. Secondly is, so my questions are two. One is about coordination of various programs within a governing context. Here in Syracuse, we have Citizens Police Review Board. I guess it's been some controversy. I don't know anything about that. But we also have such a high incidence of philanthropy that we have so many programs, as the one that was mentioned here earlier, and so many programs. What advice do you have for trying to kind of coordinate more of those programs so that we have some measurable results. I came from a public administration conference, so measurable results are the theme of every session. And then secondly, the second question is about technology. And what is the impact of technology, and what does that bring to bear and offer to help as we go forth? Oh, and I promised a third question here to our moderator.
I should have brought my pen.
And that was about, okay, so the first question is about coordinating all the good funding and good activity that's going on locally so it's achieving measurable results. Number two is the impact of technology. And number three, perhaps people noticed yesterday in the front page of the New York Times was about Ithaca trying to address the heroin problem. I guess you haven't addressed that specifically here. And like out west, Seattle, Vancouver, they're known for kind of a similar approach to Ithaca. So I heard a lot about out there. Mm-hmm. Talk about that, of all those three. That'd be great.
Okay. All right. I will do my very best in 3 minutes. Okay. I think that coordination at the local level is what is going to be most important. Coordination between city government, county government, state government, talking to one another, and beginning with the easy part of this, which is juvenile justice. So coordination amongst the various key parts of government, and then secondly, connecting government with local social programs. I think a lot of the social programs understand the dynamics of crime, of rehabilitation, of reentry. And so connecting those two, and I say that getting back to the research, because before we began down this pathway, there were interest groups who were going to Congress and telling them, this is not the way to go. You do not put people in prison because they smoke a joint. You do not ruin their lives for that reason. And these people outnumbered at congressional hearings, outnumbered law enforcement officers by 5-1. So that would be my answer, to begin to listen to the wisdom, listen to the direction that's being offered by those who are working on the ground, who are in the trenches and the weeds, if you were, and understand how you keep someone out of trouble and out of prison.
I want to thank you because I found your presentation interesting, and I've learned some things. Interesting the way you can contradict some of the accepted narratives with the facts and statistics. And one of the narratives that you described was that police are heroes. Now that we've got the
black. I didn't contradict that though.
we've got a counter narrative there that is coming up, and is reflected in the Black Lives Matter group. And of course, we've had these terrible stories over the past couple of years. Now, here's my question: is do you think that in terms of also technology, responding to the technology question, do you think that the statistics, that the incidents of white officers or just officers killing unarmed black men is a problem that's growing, or have you been able to dig in the statistics and determine that this is a problem that is just more visible today, mm-hmm. more transparent? Mm-hmm. And if so, is it possible that narratives based on fact-based narratives mm-hmm. are a big part of the solution? If you have an accurate narrative that is saying, well, this has been happening all the time, but now here, because of social media,
Absolutely.
Because of all these elements, we're seeing it happen, and that is a way to address it
Excellent.
And make it less
Excellent.
Of a problem.
Thank you so much for that question. Yes, 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 and yes. If we were to look at the statistics, and I have 100 different statistical indicators, anybody reading chapter one will get dizzy. And what the chapter actually shows is that this is a regular occurrence. This is nothing new. This has been going on for decades. That is the disproportionate use of lethal force against blacks. But when you break down the race of the officers who are involved, more are black. And that makes sense because more often than not, black officers are dispatched to black communities. So we don't see that.
So I'd like to also, so you're right, yes. I'd like to also go back and just sort of clarify, I am not challenging the concept that, that police officers are heroes. I grew up in the Robert Taylor Homes of Chicago, the projects, what Reagan referred to as the concrete jungle. So I know that crime is real, and everybody wants to be able to call a police officer in a situation like that, where you claim, you know, 20% of the city's murders we did and 3% of the city's population. The difficulty comes in when you've got 2 to 3% of police officers, and I wouldn't even say that many. I'd say closer to 1 to 2% who are involved in these improprieties, which leaves the other 97-98% not involved, but an unwillingness to recognize that 1 to 2% and then to connect defense of them to defense of the entire system, rather than conceding that just like with policymakers, just like with professors, just like with priests, with doctors, in every profession, there are some bad apples. But somehow recognizing that is considered to just sort of throw police officers all together under the bus. And it need not be that. So yes, you have, I think, the wrong face. And I think what happened with the gentleman in Detroit, Freddie Gray, half of those police officers were black. We didn't talk about that. And again, when you have this, and what Donald Trump said is we need to stop bashing police officers. And I do think that even the Black Lives Matter movement could more carefully state the case. But we don't qualify. We don't sort of mediate our claims. We've got to go way out because otherwise the cameras won't show up.
We want to thank you again so much for taking the time to come to us today.
Thank you.